Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by Mobius Strip Press. I am G.R. Mobley. If you go to my site, reclaimingtherepublic.org, you will have access to my content and support documents and links. This is an educational grassroots program leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. We are going into the New York ratification debates today. Now, even though there are a lot of content, this is a voluminous debate, and it went on and on, and the truth be told, it was a lot of hot air and hyperbole. If you go through this debate, there were all the same similar assertions that were being done by the anti-federalists, that the Constitution was granting all of these general powers. The problem is that the Federalists, those who were supporting the Constitution, were not well attuned or deliberately. I will submit that Hamilton deliberately tried to constrain the whole concept of these restrictions and so forth. Never did he say, "Oh, well, this is going to create a king. This gives the federal government unlimited powers." There was nothing like that. What he didn't do was he didn't refute what they were saying. He felt, and so, like I told you before, in the debates of a contract, when the majority of all the parties clearly articulate the exact same argument, and even though there may be one group that is debating, in this particular case, the New York ratification debates, were debating the exact same issues and the exact same things, just because they didn't come up with the same supporting or the same arguments as articulated by the Federalists in the other states, what they did not do was they did not lend to the concept that you guys are absolutely correct. This is creating a monarchy. You're absolutely correct. These are general powers. That is not what happened. So there is no conflict in the limitations and the definitions of these ratification debates and what these ratification debates supported. The interesting thing is the fact that Hamilton, I believe, withheld. If you read his Federalist Papers, he was pretty clear with the hard limitations and so forth in those correspondence. And that's where I believe some people lent way too much credit to the Federalist Papers because, again, they're not official documents. They may have been influential. They may have provided insight, but they are not official documents as the ratification debates are. And in this one instance in the state of New York, you know, shame on New York for not having good delegates who were articulating these things. But you have to also understand that Hamilton did not have a lot of support by Federalists. There were not a lot of Federalists in the state of New York. So Hamilton actually had a lot of enemies, or I should say people that were not necessarily agreeing with this new constitution. Governor Clinton considered this whole new form of government as a government that was going to encroach upon his powers as a governor of a very powerful state, because New York was a pretty powerful state. It was, I think, if not the second, the third most powerful state out of all 13 states, Virginia being the first. And that's why there were a lot of heated debates in Virginia as well. But the Virginia delegates who were the Federalists, even some of the anti-Federalists like Mason, even Mason stood up and kind of supported the limitations of federalism, but he constantly kept on saying, "We need a Bill of Rights. We've got to have a Bill of Rights." Anyway, and I love the man for it because, one, he was very consistent and he held to the line of what he felt was right. Got to love the guy for that. Now, with, again, back to Hamilton. Hamilton had a lot of baggage. He had a lot of enemies. Because I think he probably had a reputation of being a forked tongue, being a soothsayer, and being somebody that would try to argue both sides of the issues as long as his arguments were supporting his own means or his own ends. And so with that, we are going to dive into these debates. I don't expect them to go beyond today. So I hope that's okay with you. I know that you would probably love to go through these debates even further. And there's plenty of content on the Mobius Strip Press page where you can get into the New York ratification debates that I've kind of highlighted. But to me, it's not well articulated, and it's not really as clear as the other debates as to the hard limitations. They just kind of meander and they go, well, you know, not really. It's really crappy retorts to the Federalists' assertions. But again, there is nowhere in the Federalist assertions in New York where they were identifying that this contract was unleashing an unlimited government, where this contract was creating the all-powerful Oz, which the progressives have asserted for the several years over the past two centuries. Now, as you know, this show is also sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org and RepublicReview.org. You also know that this show is the show that identifies the hard lines of the violations of the Constitution, what we need to do to get the federal government back into compliance, who's supposed to do it. We talk about the solution. Do you care about fixing problems? I think you do. I think America is looking for the real solution. I believe America wants to drink the elixir that actually solves the problem, that will heal our government, that will heal our republic. And that elixir is here. It is Republic Review. It is the process. It has yet to be refuted by anyone. So with that, I also want to let you know that the listen number is 605-562-4209. You're more than welcome to dial up and engage and listen. And please, if there's something you want clarity on, like when I talk about, because I got a few emails regarding, I don't think you're right on the Constitution. So we're going to get into how the Constitution was designed to allow every nation, kindred, and tongue throughout the world to be able to become a part of the greatest form of liberty, the greatest government in protecting liberty, individual sovereignty ever in the creation, or I should say, in the span of humanity, in the span and time of mankind. Now, I'll just throw this out here. Do you really believe that our Lord and Savior, the divine hand of providence that inspired this constitutional republic, would want to limit liberty to just one nation, to just a few states? Absolutely not. He would want everybody to participate in a process that would guarantee the protections of individual liberty and individual sovereignty. So why would we think otherwise? Anyway, as you know, there's lots of news that's going on. There's plenty of garbage and propaganda that is just being pumped from the mainstream media, Fox News, and so forth. Now, it's interesting, and I need to point this out again. There has yet to be a really good expose and a constant coverage of the Agenda 21, 2030 issues on any of these major news medias, any of them, even Fox. Fox is tight-lipped and completely quiet regarding the Agenda 21, the laws and the crap, the agenda that's being pumped into our American government at the state level, local level, and so forth. So there is plenty to go into, and I've probably got two or three weeks of need-to-know news that you can kind of understand some of the things that you're not hearing and how they are affecting you. I'll give you an example, and we'll get into it tomorrow. Did you know the Pentagon has been injecting into the vaccines for the flu a serum that is designed and engineered to change people's behavior regarding their religious affiliations? Yeah, so we'll be exposing some of this stuff. And some of this stuff may not have been exposed by the Need to Know News, but these are things that we've actually found and uncovered in the past couple of weeks, because obviously they're, you know, we get bombarded just like you do regarding what the heck's going on around the United States, what's going on around the world. And so we'll dive into those as we get into the kind of like the news cycle in our next episode. So if you've been jonesing for some news, we're going to cover some. But we're also going to get back into some other content before we go, you know, back into full-fledged marketing while, you know, you're getting ready to end your vacations and get your kids back into school and so forth. So I see the heartbreak. It's coming. And so when we come back from the heartbreak, we will get into the, actually, we got to do the sponsorships and so forth. Buy Red State Coffee, by the way. Go get yourself some Red State Coffee, and we'll talk about that after the break, and then we'll get into the meandering of Hamilton and the New York ratification debates. Thank you so much. Have you taken the time to watch our presentation on YouTube that provided an irrefutable argument of what we have to do to save our Constitution and our Republic? I know it's over an hour and 30 minutes, but you only need to watch the first 30 minutes. If you take the time to watch this presentation, I promise it will change your paradigm regarding what our Constitution is and what we have to do if we are going to save it, our liberties, our sovereignty, and our Republic. We already have answers to most of the questions that you might think of after watching this presentation, and we want to help you get to a point where you have a profound understanding of the audit and republic review process. This is why our bullet overview and flowchart of both the argument and process is available on reclaimingtherepublic.org. The sooner you get informed, the sooner you can get involved and make an impact. So go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to the Take Action page. That's where you'll find the video. Thank you so much. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. Okay, so the number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK or 215-867-8255. Do not forget my three C's when you dial in. And let's get on with the dialogue. Now, one of the things that I think kind of goes or defies logic, and actually there's some merit in this, defying logic at least, where people, you know, look at the hot days of summer and how can anybody drink a hot beverage? Even though it seems like it defies logic, if you understand what ends up happening whenever you drink a beverage, if it's really cold, what does your body do? Your body actually starts heating itself up because you've injected or induced a cold material, and it makes your body colder than your body wants to be. So what your body ends up doing is your body actually starts countering that and starts, you know, increasing its metabolism so it can heat you up. And thus, on a hot day, when you eat something cold, you drink something cold, you are causing your body to actually heat up. So when you actually have something like hot coffee, when you have something like tea, and in this particular case, Red State hot coffee, you will actually help, even though you're inducing the heat and you're making your body hot, what your body will do is it'll slow itself down so that you cool off. And so it may go, and it may defy logic, may it go against any common sense logic and reason to most people, when you actually eat and or drink hot things in a hot summer day, you'll actually be helping yourself cool down a little bit. Now, just to say this, I know that many people drink coffee. None of them really drink coffee to cool themselves down. I've seen people on a cold winter day, the first thing they'll do is they'll have some hot coffee or cocoa or hot drink to help warm them. And that does take the bite of the frost or the cool air or what have you out, or, you know, reduces that effect. But still, if you are looking for something that you always do anyway that you could actually consume that would actually benefit your liberties in protecting and preserving liberties in America, go get yourself some Red State coffee. And how can you get Red State coffee? If you go to reclaimingtherepublic.org, right there at the top, we have Red State coffee and a link that will take you to the website on eBay, or the page on eBay, where you can buy either grind or whole bean. Please give this a try. And once you've had your Red State coffee, we only ask that you call 425-270-5416 so that we can get your feedback, get how you have, you know, what you think of the product. We would love to have you help endorse this product. That way, other people can hear how coffee lovers alike love the taste of Red State coffee. So while you're listening to Red State Talk Radio, you can have your Red State coffee. So another way you can support us is with our crowdfunding with GoFundMe. We plead, we beg, we need some support financially to help cover our costs of travel. Now, it looks like we may not be traveling coming up in a couple of weeks going out to Wyoming, but we will be. It looks like we will be traveling in September. And I would ask, we may have to go to Cheyenne. But in this particular case, in going into Cheyenne, it won't be just a Republican event. We will be going and actually meeting with the Constitution Party as well. We are broadening our wings, and we are actually looking to get out and get involved with the other parties, because bottom line, as we start consolidating everybody who has and understands the importance of the Constitution and getting everybody to support that, we'll even be getting Democrats, because I think a true American, especially in these patriotic states, we can call them red states, but I think even the blue electorate, the Democrats in these red states, I think many of them do love the Constitution. I see that, and I hear that from even the Republicans, that they go, yeah, they're good patriots. It's just that they're misinformed. And so it's just a matter of getting them to understand the importance and centering their focus on the Constitution, which is what we try to do here. So what you can do, if you're interested in getting involved and leading, send us an email, info@reclaimingtherepublic.org, and we will get you involved, get you engaged, so that you can help become a part of the solution instead of insisting on being a part of the problem. Now, today we're focused on the New York ratification debates. And one of the things I kind of wanted to start off with, and this was a common occurrence during these debates. And this was what the journalists, or I should say the scribes who were keeping the journal for these debates. A lot of the states had two or multiple. And in New York, this is kind of comical, but I just want to kind of help you understand the rancor and the debate and the personal crap that was going on between the individuals. And more importantly, you'll notice that it was Hamilton that was involved in a lot of this stuff. Hamilton had a huge ego. You'll also notice that in the other debates where there were other really profound framers such as Madison and so forth, you won't find this kind of shenanigans going on. And so this is what was stated. The personal dispute between Mr. Hamilton and Mr. Lansing was again brought forward. So in other words, it's been happening a few times already, if not more, and occupied the attention of the committee for a considerable part of this day. And so on the termination of which the debate upon Mr. Williams' motion was resumed and continued by Mr. Wilson, or by Mr. Williams, Mr. Smith, Mr. Jay, and Mr. Jones, etc. So in other words, for the majority of the day, Hamilton and Lansing were sparring over their personal issues and differences instead of really getting into the debates. And you know what they say about wrestling with a pig? If you wrestle with a pig, at least the pig, you know, the pig loves it. And the only thing that you will find that you've been able to accomplish is that you get dirtier than snot. And so there is no point in lowering yourself to try to go out and wrestle with pig unless you just want to go get dirty. That's a great mechanism, and it's a great engagement and a fast track to getting dirty if you want to go wrestle with a pig. Now, this is what Mr. Williams, the Honorable Mr. Williams, says, and he says this, and this, he's an anti-federalist, and so he's making these assertions that were made in many of the other states, and I'm just going to give you this one view of this so that you can kind of understand that there was no difference in how they were debating the Constitution. And he says this: in the preamble, the intent of the Constitution, among other things, is declared to be, quote, to provide for the common defense and promote the general welfare, close quote. And in the clause under consideration, the power is in express words given to Congress, quote, to provide for the common defense and general welfare. And in the last paragraph of the same section, there is an express authority to make all laws which be necessary and proper for carrying into execution this power. Now, it didn't say this power, and he wasn't quoting actually what it says, and we should actually go to, because, you know, when we want to actually quote, because they're not quoting it properly, let's quote precisely what was being said in Article 1, Section 8, and this is the subsection 18, or the necessary and proper clause. And this is what it says: to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers. There's no clause, or there's no semicolon, no colon, no comma, nothing. This is the clause, which is the necessary and proper clause. I'll read it one more time. To make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers, comma. Then the final part of the clause, or the next part of the clause. And to be clear, these are only identifying the necessary and proper laws to execute the foregoing powers. And so he completely misses this. He completely misrepresents this. And then he goes on and says, it is therefore evident that the legislature under this Constitution may pass any law which they may think proper. So he's gone out on this completely wild ledge. It is true, the ninth section in the first article restrains their power with respect to certain objects, but these restrictions are very limited some of them improper, some unimportant, and others not easily understood. Sir, Congress have some of them improper. Okay. Sir, Congress have authority to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, excises, and to pass all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying this power into execution. And what limitation, if any, is set to the exercise of this power by the Constitution? Well, those couple of words right after that, the foregoing powers. It wasn't a complete blank that you can do whatever you want to do, only to execute these foregoing powers. That was it. That was very well delineated in every other debate within the constitutional ratification debates. And we will get into what else he says and how this is a complete outlier as it was debated. We'll be right back.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.
To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath even though we're not required to take it because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station.
That number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK, 215-867-8255. And again, don't forget those three C's. And if you're ready to call in, the lines are open.
And so let's continue on with what Mr. Williams is saying. And he says this: Sir, to detail the particulars comprehended in the general terms, taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, would take up more time than would be proper at present. Indeed, it would be a task far beyond my ability and to which no one can be competent unless possessed of a mind capable of comprehending every possible source of revenue, for they extend to every possible means of raising money, whether by direct or indirect taxation. Under this clause may be imposed a poll tax, a tax on houses and buildings, on windows and fireplaces, on cattle, and all kinds of personal property. It extends to duties on all kinds of goods, to tonnage and poundage of vessels, to duties on written instruments, newspapers, almanacs, etc. It comprehends an excise on all kinds of liquors, spirits, wine, cider, beer, etc. Indeed, every necessary or convenience of life, whether of foreign or homegrown or home growth of manufacture. In short, we have no conception of any in which a government can raise money from the people, but what is included in one or the other of these general terms? Every source of revenue is therefore committed to the hands of the general legislature. Not only these terms are very comprehensive and extended to a vast number of objects, but the power to lay and collect has great latitude to which lead to the passing of vast number of laws which may affect the personal rights of the citizens of the states and put their lives in jeopardy. It will open a door to the appointment of a swarm of revenue and excise officers to prey upon the honest, industrious part of the community. Let us inquire also which is implied in the authority to pass all laws which be necessary and proper to carry this power into execution. It is perhaps utterly impossible fully to define this power. The authority granted in the first clause can only be understood in its full extent by descending to all the particular cases in which a revenue can be raised. The number and variety of these cases are so endless that no man hath yet been able to reckon upon them. Now, I mean, this is a lot of hyperbole, and this is a lot of nonsense, because they can't just go after revenue for the purpose of education. Now, these were very similar arguments that were made later, and during the bounty for the cod fisheries, Madison clearly stated that if they started using these common clauses for giving, you know, the ability for Congress to raise money, he said that then they would start taking up the cause of education and religion. And everybody aghast at that, and they understood that that was, you know, that was definitely outside the scope. So anyway, he goes on and says, and when mankind had supposed the subject was exhausted, they have been astonished with the refined improvements that have been made in modern times, and especially in the English nation, on the subject. If then the objects of this power cannot be comprehended, how is it possible to understand the extent of the power which can pass all laws which be necessary and proper for carrying into execution? Now, he keeps on dropping the other two laws, the aforegoing powers, or the other few words that are critical to this clause. The aforegoing powers, not all and any necessary powers and or laws. Anyway, I go on and he says, a case cannot be conceived which is not included in this power. It is well known that the subject of revenue is the most difficult and extensive in the science of government. It requires the greatest talents of a statesman and the most numerous and exact provision of a legislature. Now, Hamilton comes back and basically kind of refutes what he's saying, but he does a crappy job. And you got to understand that there are the two parts. There's this necessary and proper clause of limiting the scope of what types of laws can be passed, only those to execute the aforegoing powers. But the whole concept of what he's talking about is the revenues. And so this is what Hamilton says. This balance between the national and state government ought to be dwelt on in the particular attention, as it is of the utmost importance. It forms a double security to the people. If one encroaches on their rights, they will find a power protection in the other. Indeed, they will both be prevented from overpassing their constitutional limits by a certain rivalship which will ever subsist between them. I am persuaded that a firm union is as necessary to perpetuate our liberties as it is to make us respectable, and experience will probably prove that the national government will be a natural guardian of freedom as the state legislatures themselves. But what did that have to do with the taxation as well as, see my point, my friends, is nowhere did Hamilton go through with an ad hominem type of argument where he went point by point by point by point in refuting what Mr. Williams had said. What he did was he just kind of generalized, you know, that these things are, you know, that the powers and jurisdictions between the state and local governments, you know, there will always be the warmest interest of the people, which will actually resolve the problems between. I mean, what did he say have anything to do with what was being said? Now, Mr. Chancellor Livingston, or the Chancellor Mr. Livingston, went on about, you know, similar types of stuff. And as we get into these things, this is what he says, but you'll notice that Hamilton's responses are really subpar because he does not go in and refute these. What he does is he just goes off on a tangent and says something about something else. So what I'm trying to say here, and I've actually said this before, Hamilton was a dubious person. Hamilton had, I believe, machinations by not actually directly refuting these any of the assertions, but coming out with outlier comments and coming out with comments that had nothing to do with the issue at hand, but other issues. I believe that he was leaving a door open so that he could come back and say, hey, look, I never said this or that, and I believe that this is an implied power. I believe Hamilton was softballing. He was marginalizing, and he was doing everything he could to lay the groundwork for him to come back around and actually do some of the things that he was doing by setting up a national bank, which was outside the boundaries of the Constitution. Now, Mr. Livingston says this, but the point on which gentlemen appear to dwell with most attention and concern is the jurisdiction of the United States and the individual states in taxation. Now, he's actually talking about the issue. They say a concurrent jurisdiction cannot exist and that the two powers will clash and one or the other must be overpowered. Their arguments are considerably plausible, but if we investigate this matter properly, we will see that the dangers they apprehend are merely idle or ideal. Their fears originate in a supposed corruption of Congress. For if the state governments are valuable and necessary to the system, it cannot be imagined that the representatives of the people, while they have a single principle of honor, honesty, will consent to abolish them. If I proceed here to prove the improbability of corruption, I should only repeat arguments which the committee already have heard clearly and copiously detailed. The fact is that in our present state of society and under the operation of this Constitution, interest and integrity will be connected by the closest ties. Interest will inform a check which nothing can overcome. On interest, sir, we rest our principal hopes of safety. Your state government has the unlimited power over the purse and the sword. Why do you not fear your rulers will raise armies to oppress and enslave the citizens? Clearly, because you feel a confidence in the men you elect, and that the confidence is founded on the conviction that you have a tyranny is totally inconsistent with their interest. You will give up to your state legislatures everything dear and valuable, but will you give no power to Congress because it may be abused? You will have no revenue because of the political treasures may be squandered, but you do not see here a capital check. Congress are to publish from time to time an account of the receipts and expenditures. These may be compared to together in the former, year after year, exceed the latter. The corruption will be detected, and the people may use the constitutional mode of redress, which is in actually Article 1, or I should say the First Amendment of the Bill of Rights. So we'll take this back up when we come back as to what he's saying, but he's actually making a good argument, but it's nothing like Madison and the other arguments regarding the necessary and proper clause and taxations and separations between states and so forth. So we'll be right back after this. Thank you so much.
Folks, Red State Talk Radio has brought back its monthly newsletter. I know everyone gets a lot of emails, but this is not a daily or weekly newsletter. It's a monthly newsletter. So you will not be overwhelmed with a plethora of emails from Red State Talk Radio. Come on, it's only once a month. I'll be contributing a constitutional perspective to one of the current issues to help everyone see an alternative perspective, or what I believe would be a framer's perspective regarding the issue to help us maintain a constitutional paradigm. I will also provide information regarding a significant historical context to the time of year so that we can remember our history, so we will not be doomed to repeat the inevitable failings from forgetting our past and origins. Just go to Red State Talk Radio and sign up for the newsletter. This way you can get a focused view of what is going on in the Republic as well as what is going on at Red State Talk Radio. Thank you.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process.
Okay, if you want to join in on the dialogue, you need to call 215-TOP-TALK. That's 215-867-8255.
And let me just kind of repeat this last sentence, because this kind of, helps people understand that there is a constitutional mode of redress. Because he says this: these may be compared together, and if the former, year after year, exceed the latter, the corruption will be detected, and the people may use the constitutional mode of redress. The gentleman admits that corruption will not take place immediately. Its operations can only be conducted by a long series and a steady system of measures. These measures will be easily defeated, even if the people, unapprised of them, they will be defeated by the continual change of members, which naturally takes place in free governments, arising from the disaffection and inconsistency of the people. Now, why is it that we do not have a good turnover in our representation because we do have a free government? It is because so much money goes to paying for the keepers of those who have sold their souls out to those who are, in other words, the adage of he who pays the piper calls the tune. And so that's why our Congress, that's why our representatives in the states and so forth are constantly bowing to those people who open up their wallet, who open up their purse and help them get in office. If you want to change this, this is where your assistance in providing money to the constitutional candidates that we're going to be getting behind next year in 2020 will be actually supporting you, the constituents, we the people, instead of those businesses who are looking for that kickback so that they can have better access to your wallet, so that they can have less competition and more constraints in protecting their businesses, because that's what businesses do. That's what globalists are doing. They're actually trying to make sure that they maintain a monopoly, if at all possible. Now, his final comment is this: a changeable assembly will be entirely incapable of conducting a system of mischief or corruption. They will meet the obstacles and embarrassments on every side. Now, Mr. Livingston gives a pretty decent articulated argument against the corruptions and so forth regarding taxes and all these other things. Here's what Hamilton says. When these are obtained, all our apprehensions of the extent of power are unjust and imaginary. What then is the structure of this Constitution? One branch of legislature is to be elected by the people, by the same people who choose your state representatives. Its members are to hold their offices 2 years and then return to their constituents. He's talking about the House of the People. Here are the people governed. Here they act by their immediate representatives. You have also a Senate constituted by your state legislatures, by men in whom you place the highest confidence and forming other representative branch. I mean, he's making a very similar comment to everybody else. Then again, you have an executive magistrate created by a form of election which merits universal admiration. In the form of this government and in the mode of legislation, you find all the checks which the greatest politicians and the best writers have ever conceived. What can be more reasonable men desire? Is there any one branch in which the whole legislative and executive powers are lodged? No. The legislative authority is lodged in these three distinct branches. Properly balanced, the executive... He's not saying anywhere here where the federal government has... the Constitution is this living document that can drift in any direction. He's basically making really the same kind of general assertions, but he's not doing a good job in refuting. I'll go on. This is what he says. This is Hamilton again. No, the legislative authority is lodged in all three distinct branches, properly balanced. The executive is divided between two branches, and the judicial is reserved for an independent body who hold their office during good behavior. This organization is so complex, so skillfully contrived, that it is next to impossible that an impolitic or wicked measure should pass the scrutiny with success. Now, what do gentlemen mean by coming forward and disclaiming against this government? Why do they say we ought to limit its power, to disable it, and to destroy its capacity of blessing the people? Has philosophy suggested, has experience taught, that a government ought to be trusted with everything necessary for the good of society? Sir, when you have divided and nicely balanced the departments of government, when you have strongly connected the virtue of your rulers with their interests, when, in short, you have rendered your system as perfect as human forms can be, you must place confidence, you must give them power. And so that kind of is the crux of how impotent and how weak Hamilton was in really trying to form arguments. There are plenty of cases where Hamilton goes down this path of, you know, getting into political theory and getting into the concepts of politics and so forth. And I think he gets into this rhetoric and this theory just to spend and waste people's time, because he knows if he drags his feet, the news will come soon that Virginia had ratified the Constitution. And then what will be the course of New York? Well, New York would then ratify the Constitution as well. I'm here to tell you that when you go through these ratification debates of Hamilton, Livingston in the New York ratification debates, you will find that there is nowhere, zero possibility, zero evidence that they support the progressive concepts of a living document or the concept that the Supreme Court is the supreme rulers. No, the sovereigns are the people and the sovereigns are the state legislatures. And there is plenty of evidence that supports the exact same. They just do a poor job. They either waste time in talking, especially Hamilton. Hamilton wastes a lot of time talking about theory and talking about concepts of government and so forth. He does this because he feels that there's no doubt in my mind, he has this duplicitness that as soon as he becomes or gets involved in government, he is going to try to argue implied powers, this concept that it may not really be there, but if you look in between the lines, it's kind of implied. That becomes the progressive redefining of the Constitution, and there is no legal basis for redefining anything when it comes to contract law. The Constitution or the contract is defined in the ratification process, period. You've got to understand this, that the terms of the contract, the terms of the Constitution, as defined during the ratification debates, are the only legally binding terms and definitions, as Hamilton and others have tried to redefine. Even if we accept how they've redefined it, it does not make it legally binding. The only legally binding definitions are those that were involved in the ratification and convincing the men in accepting the contract. Again, I can only emphasize that even if somebody comes along later and we accept their definition of a living constitution or what have you, they're not legally binding because they were not influential in the overall passage and or acceptance and the acquiescence of the contract. You have to understand that the ratification debates hold the most precious and the most, what's a better word for it? Precious and probably divine. The most divine understanding and the most divine clarifications, the most divine limitations, the most divine definitions of what is within the Constitution, what is not. As I have said, I don't have a lot of regard for Alexander Hamilton and what he was trying to do. Now, I would be willing and more than happy to address these things if we were ever face-to-face, like in heaven. I'd be happy to say, I see what you had done, and I believe what you did undermined the controls and the restraints that the states had over the federal government by the way you tried to behave after the ratification of the Constitution. In other words, trying to redefine it and changing the course of our republic. With that, my friends, we will be back tomorrow with some of the great need-to-know news and some of the other stories that you have not heard. You'll definitely want to tune into our next couple of episodes on this before we get into the rescission of the 17th Amendment and republicanism. We will be back. God bless. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. I've been on the radio for a couple of years, and for over a decade, I have been providing content to help patriots understand what has to be done if we're going to save our Constitution and our Republic. Not one academic has been able to refute my argument for Republic Review, and even most conservative entertainers will not support Republic Review due to self-interest reasons. If you have not read my bullet point descriptions and executive summaries, you need to so that you can understand what we all need to do. I'm trying to give patriots the necessary knowledge to take back our Constitution and Republic. Go to reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can read my bullet points and view the Republic Review flowchart. You can even order my executive summaries, books, and other content to understand the simplicity of what we have to do. This way, you will know what, why, and how to support the reclaiming of our Republic. Again, please take a look at my content on reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can become a part of the solution.